Thank you so much, Tom, for that. Thanks for that very generous and gracious introduction, and what a privilege it is to be here with you all today to honor the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Grains Council. I want to thank you, Tom. I want to thank the Grains Council Board. I want to thank, I want to thank Rick, and I want to thank you members of the Grains Council and the sponsors who've invited my participation. You're really here, we're all here, to honor the enormous accomplishments of the council, your council, and the U.S. grain industry over the last half century. Your achievements deserve to be celebrated, and I hope you started last night. For you've not only created enormous wealth and trade and value for every citizen of the United States of America, but you've equally benefited the lives, the diets, and the nutritional health of hundreds of millions, if not billions of people around the world. And in my view, from having watched the Grains Council and interacted with all of you over the last 35 years or so, maybe almost 40 years that I've been involved in the business, you've created very strong ties of friendship and trust between the United States and diverse countries and cultures sharing our planet. And I don't think anyone can do anything more than you've done to be ambassadors of the United States around the world. So this morning I'd like to say buenos dias, bom dia, bonjour, buongiorno, ohayo gozaimasu, ni hao, and today is the Chinese New Year, the Year of the Tiger, xin yan hao, Happy New Year, salam alaikum, and if I've missed some languages here, my apologies, but welcome and hello, and thank you for inviting me here. The theme of my topic after I spoke with Tom about it was to grow grain markets in a sustainable, brave new world. And I know many of you kind of go sustainable and think about Al Gore and, you know, all of these crazy things that some of you think are there. But Rick and I were talking about sustainable just last night and about what does sustainable really mean. And it really means, when you look at the real definitions, exactly what you all are doing, who are the shepherds and who preserve and take care of our land. Because sustainability is really about producing and using resources today while thinking about what it will mean for our children, our grandchildren, and their children's children in the future, of making sure those resources and those assets will be usable there. So we're looking really at what are we doing today that will affect our future, and what is this brave new world that Tom already talked about? In fact, I think Tom could have given my speech today. But let's look back a minute. Where were we in 1960? A lot of you weren't probably here in 1960. Some of us were very active in 1960. A new house cost less than $13,000. Average income was about $5,000 a year. A gallon of gas was 25 cents. And I remember in the 1960s when I was in graduate school in Houston, Texas, when we had gas wars, sometimes it got down as low as 14 cents a gallon. The average cost of a new car was about $2,600. My first car was a 64 and a half, can anybody guess? Mustang, yay, I should have kept it. I could have retired by now, right, you know? I could have retired it. Unfortunately, I moved to Chicago and sold it, but I think it was worth it was $1,800, and that was like a fortune. I had to work pretty hard to get that car. World population was only 3 billion people. And how many people could a farmer feed? 25 people. Well, what happened, too, in the 1960s, many of you didn't realize. All of you younger people who are here think you've invented everything. But the Internet was really created in the 1960s. It was created by the military. We had our first weather satellite and communication satellites. The laser was innovated in 1960. Maybe it had something to do with the Grains Council, do you think? Anyway, LEDs, the tape cassette, a computer mouse. Somebody look at the picture of the original computer mouse. Fiber optics. The portable calculator. I can remember working in a basis book, and when we got the portable calculator, that was like a miracle to try to calculate bond tables, which was my first job. What else was happening in 1960? The Beatles. 1960 is the year the Beatles formed. They weren't very famous right then. They were performing in Liverpool and Hamburg, and their biggest album and their first big hit, Love, Love Me Do, didn't come out till 1962. But the Beatles were formed in 1960. Now, a lot has happened since then. Where are we today? Well, the average cost of a new house, if give or take, I guess today it may be down a little bit, is about $240,000. Average income is about $40,000. A gallon of gas, if we're lucky, is $2.50. World population is merging and moving towards 7 billion, more than doubled. Obesity today, a topic I'll get into, is causing 365,000 U.S. deaths per year, second only to tobacco. And one farmer can feed 129 people. Technologies have just proliferated in this new century, the 21st century. Cell phones and Blackberries. I joke about it with friends. I said, I don't know whether I reach for my Bible or my Blackberry first in the morning or last before I go to sleep at night. Text messages, iPods, iPhones, high-speed internet, digital, 24-hour news networks, talking heads all over the place, you know. Social networking like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. You know, it really gets me mad when they ask you to put your birth date in there, and everybody says, well, you can just lie. Google, Wikipedia, Kindles. How many of you have a Kindle? Oh, God, you're brave. I still love paper. And what's happening with the Beatles today? Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney, still has a hit out in 2010, and it's called Meat Free Monday. Today's world is both larger, is smaller and larger. It's a lot smaller due to that instant communication I was talking about. Time's really collapsed with all the multitasking that we do. And with transportation, the first container ships really began operating in the mid-50s, the very beginning. And in the 60s, you started seeing containers as well as tankers in bulk. But it's also larger due to the population explosion we've seen, more than double the world's population, which has created a real global market in addition to what Rick and what Tom have talked about with the Berlin Wall collapsing, the Iron Curtain collapsing, China deciding that developing socialism, which is really capitalism, is okay. And think about it. The volume of information we have to process today. There were 31 billion Google searches every month, almost as much as our debt is going up a month. I like to think about the fact that this is a very confusing time we live in. I mean, I'm confused, but I'm always confused. But I think it's confusing for all of us. And I look at it and I say, why is it so confusing? It's so complicated. There's so much, 31 billion Google searches. It's because I think we're facing the past and the future at the same time. We're living with our existing infrastructure, everything we learned about how do you operate a business, how do you do this, how do you do that, and yet all these future things are coming at us at the same time, and they're coming so fast that you're trying to stand in one place, but the world is really spinning around you. So where are we? I think we're moving from disposability to sustainability, whether it's natural resources, production processes, or lifestyles. We're moving into a new era of focus on global public goods, global governance. This is going to affect money and finance, trade. It's going to affect climate. It's going to affect environmental negotiations. We're moving into a much more dangerous time that we're already seeing of global threats, cyber terrorism. What happens if somebody shoots down a satellite? What happens to all of our operating systems? Fragmented power. Radical groups. This isn't the Cold War where we could have the red phone, the hotline between Khrushchev and Kennedy, you know, picked up. We now have Al-Qaeda and all these other splinter groups around the world, transnational, and some of them now starting and threatening to control weapons of mass destruction, supported by countries like Iran with all the proliferation there. And any one of you have involved in shipping and trading, I'll tell you, piracy has returned to the high seas. And this isn't Captain Hook. This is Somalian pirates in the Gulf and in the Malaccan Straits in Southeast Asia, attacking oil routes, attacking major vital shipping routes from Asia into the world or the oil countries into the world. But I'd like to talk a little bit about what I first learned when I started working at the Board of Trade in 1972, before the Russians started buying grain. And that was a trend in motion is a trend in motion. I'm sure many of you have heard this. So the four trends in motion that I see today reshaping the world are a rebalancing in global wealth and power, a revolution in energy supply and markets, a rebellion against our modern food system, and a resurgence and interest of, and investment in commodities and in agriculture. Rebalancing of global wealth and power. We are going to see much more volatility, instability in both policy and markets. Now remember, volatility and instability in both policy and markets. GDP can be higher than expected one quarter, much lower than expected the next quarter. Everything is in a state of flux. And instability means that the old ways of looking at things, decision making, just aren't there anymore. There's the liberal model of open finance and dynamic open markets, the old GATT and WTO. These models are being changed. And it's being changed also because climate issues and trade issues are merging in the same face of things. We've lost credibility as the United States with Enron, with the dot-com bubble, with the subprime and economic collapse. Our model has been damaged very, very severely. The G8 is died, the G20 is emerging, and there's a whole new balance and shift to the G20 of powerful countries and a wealth shift to the BRICS. You've heard about the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China. Global GDP is about $65 trillion. They now have about $16 trillion led by China with about $8 trillion. Then you've got what's called the N11. Someone at Goldman Sachs coined that term for the next emerged 11. And Mexico is very proud. Mexico's right at the top of that list with about a trillion six GDP, and then South Korea with about $1.4 trillion GDP. But you've got Algeria and Egypt, Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Vietnam, the Philippines, who are all part of your markets. And I would probably also add Colombia and Malaysia. U.S. national security is still on top, but we're dominant, but we may not be dominant so much anymore if we don't have the money to put into it. It costs $90 billion a year, $90 billion a year for the Navy just to protect the sea lanes that are bringing oil from the Persian or the Arabian Gulf to the world, to the world's customers. That's $90 billion a year, and we've got deficits that are growing and growing. Now there's talk about a new reserve currency against the U.S. dollar, a multipolar currency world. And how many of you remember 1978 and all the crises, the oil crisis? I remember Carter bonds. Does anybody remember Carter bonds in here? 1978, the United States had to go to the IMF for money, and we also, no one wanted dollars. So we issued a series of treasury bonds called Carter bonds, and we committed to pay people back in Swiss franc, in Japanese yen, and in Deutschmarks, because they wouldn't take U.S. dollars. China is very confident. China is one of the two major superpowers. If you look at money and wealth and growth, if you look at power or national security issues, who is the real superpower? China's now the world's largest exporter. China's has the largest consumer of automobiles today. China is moving forward on many, many fronts, and I think we have to keep that in mind. It's not something to fear, but it is a rebalancing. It is a shift. How do we accommodate it? How do we manage it? There's also demographic shifts, which are seismic. The Old West is aging. Europe and Japan are a ticking time bomb for deficits and social costs, and so is the United States. These are just gathered photographs of an American woman of the age 100, an old Frenchman looking at his wines, a Russian woman in the Kremlin, Japanese tourists, elderly tourists, and an Italian older couple sitting there probably at one of their monuments in Rome. But the younger population, the U.S. is very blessed to have had, up until now, an open immigration policy. So we have a wonderful, rich Asian and Hispanic heritage that's come into our country that can help us become this dynamic, growing world. And fortunately, we don't have the same demographic problems as Western Europe and even the and Eastern Europe have in very aging populations, and also Japan. China and India are leading this new world, and they are have more than 40% of the world's population. By 2050, there will be 9 billion people. Over 60% will live in South Asia, East Asia, and Africa. Over 60% in South Asia, East Asia, and Africa. And Islamic populations have the fastest growing birth rates. There are already, we always talk about a billion Chinese, a billion Indians. There are already over a billion people who practice the Muslim faith today in the world. So my suggestion to you all is that you look east and south and Mecca for markets. East and south and Mecca for markets. The Western Hemisphere has a billion people, of which two-thirds of them in our hemisphere are south of the U.S. border, and they're growing in both size and in wealth, as you know from your own markets and what you've achieved in these markets so far. We've got a rebalancing of power I'd like to get in a little more detail. These global economic leadership shifts are happening. Investments also are shifting. We always would see U.S. multinationals, European multinationals, Japanese investing in developing or emerging countries. Well, now there's much, much south-south and south-north investment. You've got Vale from Brazil, who's very active in Canada in mining and other areas, has just brought Bunge's fertilizer business. You've got the South African brewery, which has invested tremendously through Africa, but now owns Miller's, a very large Belgian brewery, a major Colombian brewery. You've got China's Investment Corporation owns part of Vale, owns Noble Trading, and the list of U.S. companies that have come out that they have little shares in is quite remarkable. They've been very smart at diversifying their investments. You've got a multipolar world with regional trade and currencies. Some oil transactions today are already being settled in a basket of currencies. Kuwait is pricing some of their oil in a basket of currencies. You've got people talking about a renminbi zone, which is the Chinese currency, in Southeast Asia and ASEAN. There's a lot of pressure now to take away from the U.S. dominance as the only currency that's going to be used in international trade. You've got global negotiations that are no longer the U.S. and Europe negotiating, and as we did in the Uruguay round, which I remember only too well, and how we could shape the deal and then give it to others with the Cairns Group and everything. Now you've got all the G77 and the G this and the G that and OG, and I'll tell you, they're all being driven, plus all the NGO players, the Battle for Seattle, the Copenhagen. All of these things are happening. And we are not going to have the same amount of power because we don't control the same amount of the global economy anymore. We've created wealth in the world. And countries themselves have created wealth in the world for their own people. Emerging powers are establishing their own brands, supply chain dominance, and their own models. And we are going to have to realize they are going to teach us as well as we are going to teach them. This isn't a multipolar world. This isn't us going and preaching to the rest of the world. This is our becoming part of the world, and we're going to face wider competition to maintain growth and grow market size. A very exciting thing happening is the revolution in energy supply. This is being fueled by climate change, resource depletion, energy security, and technological innovation, and all of them are important. Climate change. Why is it happening? What's happening? What to do? There's certainly a range of belief in this room about whether it's even happening, if industrialization impacts climate, if it's a natural or a man-made cycle, whether it's really sunspots that are affecting things, or El Nino, or volcanoes, or water and tidal currents. And I have friends who say it's really the Mayan calendar, and we're heading toward the end of the world in 2012. And many of you will remember the global cooling theory of the 1970s. Global warming, a lot of these charts long-term show that the Earth is warming. And I know many of you probably say may not be happening. I have my own theory about why climate is changing, and I'd like to share it with you today. In January 2010, the journal Nature revealed a stunning new report, and this is true. that the male Y chromosome is now by far the most rapidly evolving part of the human genome, and it's constantly renewing itself, and it throws out 50 years of scientific theory of a rotting Y chromosome. So maybe it's the Y files that's really affecting the climate today and causing these enormous pressures that are affecting our universe. In any case, what's ahead? Well, from the past several years, whether it's all of these above or none of the above, something's going on. I think all of us would agree that something is going on, that the planet is unstable, that things are more uncertain. Maybe it's Washington that's creating this, all the political dissent. Maybe it's MSNBC and Fox News fighting each other. I don't know. But anyway, but what we do see happening is droughts, natural disasters, the glacier. Glaciers are melting. How fast is up in question. We know that the Arctic shelves are melting and the Antarctic shelves. I believe that there's going to be a battle for the Arctic and the Antarctic in terms of shipping routes, in terms of minerals, in terms of petrochemicals potentially. And this is going to be an emerging national security target as the ice caps melt. By the way, that's Katrina. As many of you will recognize, you're going down to New Orleans next year, I believe. And this is a real photograph taken in an area of Australia in 2008 when they were suffering from the drought. But we will be setting carbon standards. We will be dealing with, after the collapse of Copenhagen, we're going to be having the next big meeting is going to be here in Mexico in December, and you have to become involved in shaping that policy for the United States and in understanding the policy of the countries in which you operate, because this is a moving target and it's going to be very, very important for our competitive position. In the meantime, business is already leading the game, as I was saying. Business is leading. If you've never heard of the Carbon Disclosure Project, you should, because there is a whole move afoot on carbon footprint labeling, and all the major companies led by Walmart, all the major food retailers led by Walmart and many of the processors are part of the Carbon Disclosure Project to set carbon standards and harmonization for carbon labeling. There is a major move also in carbon trading. I'm privileged to be on the board of the Chicago Climate Exchange, and a number of farmers have been able to make some money in the past several years doing offsets in this voluntary market. I'm a member of the Climate Exchange PLC board, which owns the European Climate Exchange, in which the markets are already getting very mature, and they're worth billions of dollars, and they're moving forward very rapidly to help manage carbon in a very efficient and cost-effective way to reduce it and to allow the efficiencies to stay in the economy. The SEC just recently required an advice on any publicly listed company is going to have to put in their annual reports, their filings, what they're doing to manage climate risk. And I would argue that you're going to see finance and commodity firms moving more rapidly to understand and trade CO2, that supply chain standards are going to be developing. They're going to be led by retailers. And you need to be involved in this no less than you've been involved in indirect land use issues in terms of ethanol. We also have an issue of resource depletion. You know, more people chasing fewer goods or goods that are there at the cost we have it. Some people believe in peak oil. I guess I don't. I believe in peak oil to a point, but at least at the cost of production that we have now, we've got technologies that are becoming more expensive, able to extract oil in harder areas, but they're going to be more expensive. You've got the cost. You've got CO2 challenges. And look where oil is being produced today, who we have to depend on. The Arabian Gulf, Nigeria, and Russia aren't exactly reliable suppliers. You've got a hostility in Venezuela and Iran. You've got uncertainty in all these African countries like Gabon and Equatorial Guinea. You've got reliable Western Hemisphere suppliers, Canadian oil sands. Mexico is certainly a reliable supplier, but reserves are going down. Production isn't what it used to be. And Brazil, energy is emerging to become a very big platform in Brazil. And remember, Brazil got involved big time in sugar ethanol in the 70s because they had no oil or no energy during the oil embargo then. I would watch for oil price spikes, volatility based on security issues or demand issues. We bounced back to $80 a barrel, $70 to $80 a barrel from $40 last year. And depending on the dollar and demand and a security threat, we could be seeing $100 to $150 oil. Water. Water everywhere. Water rationing. Are we going to be rationing water? We're already seeing competition in California big time. Some of this driven by, I think, some very stupid environmental considerations that I think are protecting certain minor species versus real incomes, but that's my own personal opinion. But anyway, by 2025, nearly 4 billion people, nearly 3 billion people in nearly 48 countries will face water stress or scarcity. There's a water footprint network that's begun. Pepsi, Starbucks, Coca-Cola is actively involved. The Norwegian government is supporting work in this area. And agriculture, processing, and production are going to be a target. Food is a big consumer of water. 20 gallons of water to produce one pint of beer, 132 gallons of water to produce a 2-liter bottle of soft drinks, and 75 gallons of water to bring a steer to slaughter. There will be pressures on farms, and there will be pressures on the food industry from inputs to supermarket shelves to reduce H2O content. Renewable solutions, an exciting part of this change. As Tom said, there's a revolution in genomics, there's a revolution in physics. The world is changing as we know it. Technology is racing from the labs to our land. Wind, solar, clean coal, carbon capture storage, nuclear, geothermal, algae, anaerobic digestion, biofuels from municipal solid waste, biomass, biobutanol, BP and DuPont. They're going to launch their first plant. It's going to open in 2012 in the UK, which can be shipped through existing pipelines, ethanol from corn, from sugar, cellulosic. We've got agricultural offsets already starting in rangeland carbon that are trading, soil conservation, forestry, livestock emissions with digesters. I learned from Chris last night that there is a project in Indonesia that's off and running that the carbon credits are being sold from a livestock containment operation, a feedlot, where those carbon credits being captured to produce the power, and those are actually being sold and traded. If we get it right in the United States, if we get it right, we will have distributive energy, something that Tom has been preaching for 10 years, quite a while. He was a real leader in this kind of thinking. If the United States gets it right in our regulations, if we get our grid right, if the rural electric cooperatives, if the utilities in your areas get it right, and you need to be involved in this, this is a very powerful issue for agriculture to be able to optimize the returns from your land, both from crops and from power. And those emerging energy opportunities are real. So the challenging trends, renewable energy, will be the new battleground for global competitiveness. China's already the number one producer of wind power turbines, of solar photovoltaic panels, of nuclear. They're at 1%. They're going to be moving up to 10% of their power from nuclear. They're building 5 new plants. They are the major producer of some major raw rare earth minerals, which are critical to renewable energy. We've got legal challenges coming up linked to climate issues, which will impact trade and WTO agreements. We've got, if weather patterns happen that are bad, somebody can start suing oil companies. It's already happening in the Northeast United States, claiming they're bringing about global warming and therefore they're responsible for paying some of the cost to the communities of cleaning up. Consumers are demanding brand sustainability based on what I just talked about. Food miles. How many of you have heard of food miles? Food miles may be the new protectionism. Because food miles are the idea that the more you ship stuff, transportation creates CO2 emissions, and therefore nobody should buy anything that's imported. Now, that's going to be used as a new kind of protectionism. The challenge will be to you to measure and manage your CO2 and your H2O for your customers, to adopt renewable energy inputs, to respond to climate and trade-tied protection, and to benefit from those opportunities, because carbon trading may become the biggest commodity market in the future. There's also a rebellion against the modern food system. Food is the new tobacco. Everyone loves to hate food. Food is killing our children, bankrupting our healthcare system, destroying our land and water, and endangering our planet. How many of you heard of these one way or another recently? I'm sure you've all heard this. Food corporates are causing food insecurity, according to the UN. Welcome to this brave new world, and how people see the results of 50 years of advances in building our global food system and feeding 7 billion people today. There's a fast food phobia. How about a nice Kentucky Fried factory farm pandemic bird flu value meal? Obesity. Type 2 diabetes is something serious. It's on the rise, and it tracks the growth of the fast food industry. 34% of U.S. adults, 70% of children. 68% of adults are overweight, a third of children. Total direct and indirect costs, over $117 billion a year. The blame game. Is it processed foods and fast foods, fats, salts, sweeteners, labeling, which is not true and honest, or portion sizes? Is it calorie counts that aren't, the people don't understand? Or is it lifestyles? Have we just become sitting down all the time, where mealtime is all the time, where we become couch potatoes? I walk a lot in New York, and I go to parking lots. How many of you, when you go to a parking lot at the supermarket, wait to find a parking place in the front row or at Walmart? Huh? How many of you? My sister did it in Phoenix. You know, you can't walk one car length. I mean, these are real issues in lifestyle. We're consuming calories for people who live active lives, and all we're doing is sitting and punching buttons on a computer screen. Or some people believe that the real culprit is corn subsidies. How many of you have seen the movie Food, Inc.? I advise it for everyone here. Everyone is watching it in Europe and around the world. I can tell you this right now, Food, Inc. Cheap feeds, HFCS, and cheap corn subsidies creates HFCS, and that is what's causing all the disease and all the ills of the world. So you'd better get ready now to respond to industry and government pressures to reformulate and relaunch brands. It's happening, and it's going to be moving very, very quickly. People see these pictures, and people say, we've got to do something. There's also a trend against livestock and big agriculture. Sir Paul, as I mentioned, is singing Meat Free Monday. And in the EU, he's looking to fight global warming with people telling him not to eat meat, to fight water shortages, to fight deforestation. Oprah Winfrey is dancing to Michael Pollan, the omnivore's dilemma, which is he's saying Meat Free Monday. And in Baltimore, the school system has already started instituting Meat Free Monday. Big agriculture is somehow evil. It's no longer Microsoft that's taking over the world. It's Monsanto, or it's dairy co-ops, or it's all these different big concentrated groups that are now the target that big is bad. Public distrust big corporates, and in agriculture, they love fair trade. They like the idea of buying their coffee from little Juan Valdez or others around the world because it makes them feel good that they're giving the money really to that person. And it's particularly a trend among young people. The UN has actually targeted the control of the food system is one of the causes of global hunger. You won't believe it in a UN report. A very interesting environmental writer in the UK has said, for food security, our prime objective must be feeding people, not making profits for large business corporations as now. Well, of course, Mr. Tudge, Colin Tudge, that's a real British name, hasn't been hungry over the last 50 years thanks to modern big agricultures, farmers, ranchers, and agribusiness advances. But what's really happening, all kidding aside, is that this is a sustainable diet shift in motion. There will be a new definition of what are sustainable diets, from inputs and processes to food choices and serving sizes. There will be new regulations and legislation. The American Medical Association, the White House, the First Lady, Michelle Obama, just announced a whole campaign to get kids more active and not eating as much. And the Grocery Manufacturers Association is right on board that. There's a rise of organics. There's a rise of vegetarians and vegans. Walmart now dominates the U.S. sales of organics. And the Humane Society is also no longer just defending pets in your home. It's also against meat consumption. USDA is very importantly revising dietary guidelines in 2010 to focus on vegetable protein, and this is just starting now. And U.S. demographics More than 10% of the aged people, 25 to 34, are vegetarians, and organics are growing by 18% annually. U.S. and Western consumer trends will translate into shifting emerging market consumer demand because demographics, particularly the youth in these countries, who are the biggest part of the population, will be twittering with their friends over here. And if they say, I don't eat meat and I'm healthier and I'm thinner and I'm more beautiful, watch out. So you'd better be very aware of that and look at what you need to do in terms of your marketing and your product mixes and your product sales. The good news is that there's a resurgence of interest in commodities and agriculture. We had no sex appeal in the 70s to the 90s because we had cheap commodities after, and we had good productivity. But in 07, 08, was it a commodity bubble or a bull market trend? I would argue that it's a bull market trend. That's my view. Some others join my view. But today, even today, in 2009-10, due to El Nino or other weather issues, cocoa's hit a 30-year high, tea has hit an all-time high, sugar a 28-year high, and coffee an 11-year high. Commodity investment inflows rose to $60 billion in 2009. And the IMF is forecasting commodity prices in 2010 rising again after the biggest annual price increase in 40 years in 2009. And a big part of that was the spike up in oil from the low of $35, $40 a barrel at the start of the financial crisis. But it's recovered to $75, $80 a barrel. Is this a long-term bull market? I think it is. Hugh Grant of Monsanto has said he thinks that the recession's merely masking the effects of the 2008 food crisis. Grains today, I know you're concerned because prices are down, but I would say congratulations. We could not have had prices going straight up. If we'd had prices going straight up, we would have had government controls all around the world. I promise you, we were heading in that direction as we were speaking of it at that point, and Rick and I talked about that last night too. But all indicators, according to at least to a partner of PricewaterhouseCooper, are pointing in one direction, food scarcity. I would say food challenges in the future more than scarcity. We've got those 2 billion people yet to emerge. We've got ag productivity, which is no longer growing at the rate of population. We have the biofuels mandates, which is creating a new demand stream for corn. I don't believe it was the cause of the 2008 food crisis, and I think you would all agree. Hoarding was more in rice and wheat. Exporters embargoed sales, Ukraine and Argentina. The EU, because it has GM phobia, reversed from being an exporter to an importer. But all those factors, I think, created that food shock, and it's created a lot of more interest in agriculture land and in agricultural supply chains. How are we going to feed 90 million more people per year, or 100 million more people, depending on the numbers you look at, on existing land? The FAO says that ag output must increase 1% a year, 23 million metric tons of cereals a year. 90% of the world's arable land is already in use, and there has been already a land rush of food deficit countries like South Korea, the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Emirates, and China, and financial giants like Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, starting land funds, investment funds in agriculture, primary agriculture. Investors are targeting land leases and ownership. The African savanna, which is a billion acres, reaching east to Ethiopia and southwest to Congo and Angola. The Saudis have invested heavily in Ethiopia, some in Somalia. They are moving in there to really try to begin to take over the food to begin to produce more food for their markets. And the head of the Arab Authority for Ag Investment and Development has actually said the only way to assure food security is to control production. Australia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Vietnam have also been countries that have attracted agriculture investment, both through funds and direct investment from sovereigns. Global food security, what's sustainability? Is it organic? We stick to the land. We just are locatarians. We only eat local product where it's direct seasonally produced and direct farm sourced. Or is large-scale farming, commercial farming, and open trade key to global food security? A debate in the UK is fascinating. I'm over there quite a bit, so I follow it a lot now because I'm on a few boards over there. You know, their chief scientist actually said the world needs GM crops and scientific methods and scale to feed the population, while their environmental minister is saying, well, all you need to do is produce and consume locally with lower environmental footprints and eat less meat and then only grass-fed meat. But experience, I think, has taught us that we have to draw upon that sustainable global food security will depend on intensive, large-scale agriculture and expanding global trade. But we will face competition for land and water resources, and we have to be aware of that. Where do we go from here? As I said, we're rebalancing the global access of power and markets. We're reinventing energy and as we know it and the technologies that run our world. We're restructuring production and markets for the food we eat, where we produce it, who controls it, and how it's traded. Both your risk and reward will be multiplied. Your risk and reward will be multiplied. Your complexity of choices and competition will be magnified. This is not going to be, as Tom so eloquently said, and Rick this morning, this is not going to be business as usual. You're going out there to invent yourself just like you did in 1960 in a new world. I was thinking a lot about what you'd accomplished and the brand of U.S. grains around the world everywhere I go. And another brand as I was thinking about this, which is IBM. You're an American icon, the global brand feeding the world with U.S. grains. We're the Saudi Arabia of grain in the world. IBM is an American icon, a global brand, the leading IT in the world, from the very basic mainframes and pre-mainframes they did at calculators and adding machines. Both of you are knowledge and commodity businesses, both. Knowledge and commodity. Think about that. IBM's strategy has changed in the last few years. IBM sold its mass market home and business computer business to China's Lenovo, because it knew anyone can manufacture and market a low-value bulk commodity, a laptop computer, and stick the software in it. And IBM chose to focus on higher-value next ideas and knowledge instead, leading from their base, which I also believe is your base, is the knowledge you have in your industry. So IBM has got a whole new focus. A need for change is a need for smart. IBM defines value of their brand. They define the value of the brand on their website as the way we think, the way we think. They're adding value through innovation, through smart systems, and using those systems to build the relationships of the 21st century. As I look at it, an icon has reinvented its brand. It's seeing and shaping the world as it is today, as it will be, and not as it used to be. So it stopped being a bulk commodity supplier. It's focusing on adding value and knowledge. So I'd like to give you the top 10 that I see for you to be thinking about in the next few days. What is your strategy for global growth? As Tom said, are you approaching the marketing of DDGs the same as a commodity corn? What are your mission-critical policies and resources? Do you have an IT strategy to support your mission? What global changes will impact your strategies and competitive market position? Do you have, for example, an effective carbon or climate policy in development which would allow you to respond to your customers? What new market challenges do you face? Do you have the right product mix for this market? What rapid technological innovation? What is this doing to you, from your inputs to your consumers? Can your customers, through you, access least-cost formulations on the fly and count on you to deliver them? How can you build a smarter operating platform? Do you have the right and appropriate technologies to do it? How can you build a smarter supply chain? Are your producer members able to capitalize on their investments in production and enable them to capture new markets and retain present market share as you innovate your product mix for end users, or are you doing that? Can your customers access least cost formulations, as I said? Can they? I remember in 1972, 73, I think people reset their feed formulas every month. Because during El Nino then and all those crises and everything like that, people just had this. They couldn't just do it in an instant. Are you pre-positioned in some areas for this? How can you create smarter consumers and partners in the local and global markets you serve? Do your customers have access to all the appropriate knowledge, which enables them to both rely and depend on the U.S. Customers, on U.S. customers as suppliers? Are you fighting the future? Is your energy spent in Washington fighting the future or shaping and creating the future? I kind of did a real simple little triangle. I love triangles because they always mean change to me. But how are you creating your new roadmap to grow smarter grain markets? You start at the past in 1960 at your base, and you take those core ideas and who you are and your mission and your identity, and you move that forward. Then you move over here. You take your experience, which led you to today, and then you add all the innovative thinking you have today, and that's what you're going to be doing to creating your new roadmap, just as you did in 1960. I'd like to close with a quote that's one of my favorites. People can be divided, I'm sure many of you have heard this many times. People can be divided into three classes: the few who make things happen, the many who watch things happen, and the overwhelming majority who have no idea what's happened. Well, I think the U.S. Grains Council has the experience and the imagination to make things happen. I think you're going to renew your mission in 2010, and you're going to lead in feeding a growing and dynamic world of 9 billion lives over the next 50 years. And I certainly look forward to hopefully watching you do just that. Thank you. If anybody's got any questions, if you're not brain dead by now, oh, goodness.
And I think we've got some mobile mics out here, so why don't you wait until you get the mic and then go ahead and ask a question. Adele?
Thanks for a presentation. I would like to know, what is your outlook, midterm outlook and long-term outlook for U.S. dollar?
I think it's going to be extraordinarily volatile over the next 2 years. At least over the next year. I think that the euro got overvalued against the U.S. dollar, but I think what we've seen happening today with the threat crisis in Greece and the threat to actually the eurozone as a real eurozone, I think you saw the flight to safety, quote, with fleeing to the U.S. dollar now, so we've rebalanced down a little bit in terms of regained a little bit of power. But I think the U.S. dollar is basically, it's going to be very volatile. I think it's going to be under pressure if we don't get our policy house in order. We are issuing, our debt is way too high. Our deficit is way too high. We have the blind leading the blind, the Republicans and Democrats in Washington, excuse me for saying it. Only 25 members, just a factoid, only 25 members of the U.S. Senate today have ever had any private sector business experience or worked in the private sector. All the rest have been in the political system or legal linked to politics and everything. They're clueless, and the system is so corrupted right now by the volume of money that's floating in there, it's just obscene. So I think we're going to have a very tough time. And one thing to watch, which will create really watch the acceptance of treasuries, because treasury financings have been pretty well accepted recently. They are all short term, is what treasury is doing to save money this year and the next year, but they are issuing more TIPS. How many of you know about TIPS, inflation protected securities? The Treasury pays less interest short term, but then they lock in inflation protection to bondholders over the life of the bond. And major buyers of Treasuries today have demanded more TIPS, and there will be 40% more TIPS issued this year as part of Treasuries, and there are already over $600 billion of TIPS in the marketplace. So in answering your question, it's going to be volatile. It's going to be unexpected. National security issues will drive money to the dollar. If the eurozone starts to collapse, it'll rebalance that. but because we're the strongest standing of everybody in the world, of the weakest, but we're going to see challenges to the dollar in the next few years. I hope I answered your question. I wish I knew.
Does that higher issuance rate of TIPS imply that inflationary expectations are
absolutely, absolutely. Inflationary expectations are going, and you all know, too, it's like the U.S. is issuing arms to itself. You know, 1 year, zero interest, but it jumps to 21% in 5 years, or whatever the market says it is, and that's what's happening. It's a game, and I have no idea why members of Congress and why the financial press are not calling more attention to this. It's very dangerous. It's a real dangerous game we're playing. And I think, Rick, you're very right. I think many people believe, and I guess I believe too, that our only way out of this is going to be to inflate our way out of this. The world will have to inflate our way out of this.
Tim.
And China knows this. Thank you.
Building upon what you just said and talking about the food trends that you described, it's been the affluence of North America and Europe that have allowed these food trends to develop. But taking what you just said, could the financial situation we're in today derail the food trends that you said we need to deal with?
Well, I think what you're seeing, remember something. Remember that if you look at China and these other BRIC countries and new industrial economies, the N11 and others, their GDP is marching past our GDP and even Europe's GDP. And China's trade has shifted dramatically. Not that they don't need the U.S. market or old Europe or whatever, but a lot more of their trade is intra-Asian trade and trade with ASEAN, trade with Africa, and South-South trade with Brazil. That is a growing share of trade. So there will be a balance to us. I don't think it's going to derail food trends. I think food trends will be shifting, and I think diets will be shifting somewhat in what people really want. But I think it may grow at a slower pace, but I think the trend's inevitable. And the reason I say that, do any of you in this room believe that the United States government would accept 12 or 15% unemployment? Do any of you believe that we would not trade inflation for depression? And so that's where I'm particularly, despite the financial fiasco that we are still living through, the government of Goldman Sachs and company, and I'm not saying Goldman's evil or bad. I just think that they're very smart, and they were able to control a lot of things, and they're a proxy for the evils of the financial services industry, which has grown dramatically to the point that the financial services industry in 2007, read Kevin Phillips' book, Bad Money. I gave it to Tom, didn't I, Tom? 37% of U.S. corporate profits in 2007 were in the financial services industry. Total U.S. corporate profits. Big numbers. So there's huge shifts that are going to have to take place internally. I'm bullish on long-term demand growth for commodities, for growth in food. And remember, there's going to be more erratic weather also. And I think we're going to have to depend on where we have good supplies of water, good supplies of arable land, and very good technologies. And I think... someday somebody should be, if people are talking about their people starving and they won't use GM technologies, somebody should tell them that they're responsible, that we're not responsible.
Over here. Ron?
Carol, could you comment about carbon trading and where you see that going? Is a voluntary system going to be sustainable, or do you think the government is going to mandate a system that will eventually drive carbon trading?
Well, that's a whole long other speech, and I appreciate it. I'm very bullish on carbon markets globally. I think it's going to be a lot harder to get there because of the way policy's been mismanaged over the last year. I don't think that the climate bills that were put forward in the House and Senate were the appropriate bills at this time. They went way beyond where the American people are. Europe's system is working, despite what anybody says. It's working brilliantly, because despite Europe's love of taxes, Europe allocated all their permits and actually did a pilot program for a year, and then they allocated the rest of their permits, as I said, no auctioning, no taxes, no cap and tax, to the major utilities and the major to the utilities and the major large industrial quote polluters or emitters. And the carbon market is just look at the European Climate Exchange website, ECX website. Trade is growing by hundreds of thousands of tons of carbon a day. It's really effective, and prices are going down now versus going up, because despite a cap and a reduction that they have to do every year, the markets are down because demand is weaker, and that's what markets are supposed to do. It's allocating and allowing trading to take place. It was moving very rapidly in Chicago, as some of you may have known, at CCX, but the voluntary market is very weak now because no one knows whether offsets are going to have any value. I think we're going to have to go to some type of system in the United States, and I think globally you'll see it happening. And I'm going in March to visit China, where I'm going to visit the Tianjin Climate Exchange, which is owned by the Chicago Climate Exchange. And you all may be interested to know that the joint venture partners of our exchange are a very small company called Chinese National Petroleum Corporation Asset Management Company, PetroChina, which is the largest company in the world and involved in oil and gas as well, and also the city of Tianjin, and blessed, obviously, by the government of China to be an innovative platform. And they're trading energy intensity. The first trades just happened in that. A deal was done between Gazprom and Citibank on energy intensity gains, offsets done in the city of Tianjin. China is leading in this whole area, and we're all going to have to catch up with them. The markets, Bart Chilton has said, are going to be bigger than any other commodity market we've ever seen over time.
We've got time. Good question. For one more. Wendell?
Offer a corollary to your few people make things happen. It seems to me like we spend most of our time dealing with a few people that stop things from happening. We don't want energy expansion in the United States. We're fighting battles, the people to stop progress rather than create it, it seems to me like. Your thoughts?
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's become a gotcha game on television. I think it's talking the heads and doing this and doing that. It's a game to capture the bases of parties. I think our country is in gridlock. And I don't know if it's a Tea Party or what, but we need some type of rebellion against the system that's happening. We need to get people like yourselves and others to run for office who have real business experience, who know what it means to create a job and make a dollar. And I would argue that I think that when we look again at what's happening in this new world, we have an energy revolution happening. And if we're going to feed and clothe and create a dynamic world for 9 billion people, which we can, we have the technologies to make it happen. But if people block it and they say, this is stupid, we're not going to do it, we've always controlled our grid, we've always done this, we are going to fall further and further behind in our competitiveness. And we're going to be reactive to disasters instead of proactive to opportunities. And I think that's a very wise thing. When are you going to run for office? Thank you very much.